Good afternoon, everyone. The panel has before the full court. Sitting at the panel has before simply one case, appeal number 2007-1130, In re Bielski. The argument time is 30 minutes per side, with amici adding 10 minutes, one on each side. We already had one cell phone infraction, so I'm alerting the next offender that there'll be trouble. So if you're not disabled, shut down, you better leave the room. Mr. Hansen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the court. Please proceed.
Thank you, and thank you for holding this en banc hearing. Apparently, there's a bit of interest in it.
Oh.
I would like to go directly to the issue that's been raised in some of the briefs as to whether or not Bielski Claim 1 simply claims an abstract method, in the nature of hedging. But like every patent case, we first have to start out with the claim. We have to look at the meaning of the claim and try to understand what the inventor was attempting to cover with the claim. In this case, there's only one claim. It's a process or a method claim. It has three steps. There's a preamble to it. And the way it works is this. The purpose of the claim is to enable the sale of a commodity. And to enable the sale of a commodity by managing consumption risk. Now, I'd like to talk about consumption risk for just a minute. Consumption risk is that risk that takes place when there is a possibility for more or less of a commodity being consumed in a given period of time.
Mr. Hansen, I think we understand what the invention is. Why don't you tell us why the Patent Office rejection was wrong?
The Patent Office rejection was wrong because one of its rejections was that the claim simply covered the abstract idea of hedging. And that's the reason that I would say, and that's why I'm attempting to point out some of the things about the claim that might not be clear in view of some of the comments that are appearing in some of the briefs. Consumption risk, I've just explained. Price risk is different from consumption risk, and price risk is the risk that the price will be above or below some level during a given period of time.
Are you advocating for a useful, concrete, and tangible test? Is that what you think the test ought to be?
That test is fine, Your Honor. I think that test will work in this case, and I think that test is consistent with the rule that I would draw.
So what's the basis for that test? Where does that test come from? Put aside our panel decisions in State Street and AT&T. What's the basis for your argument that that's the appropriate test under the statute?
I would say the basis of that is it's consistent with the Supreme Court's rules or decisions in Benson, Fluke, and Deere. In those three cases, which are different than this, in that those three cases involve mathematical algorithms or mathematical formulas, whereas there is no mathematical algorithm and formula in this case, to draw a rule from those three cases that would apply to this, I draw the rule that what they were trying to cover was that an idea itself is not patentable. That's pretty well accepted. And that if an idea is involved, it must be adapted and applied to a practical use in a non-trivial way. And the useful, abstract, and concrete result test is totally consonant with that rule.
Is transformation required under your rule? Transformation of any data or otherwise?
I don't believe transformation of any data is required. There has to be communication and transfer of information. Step number one, wherein the commodity provider provides or enters a transaction with a plurality of customers at a fixed price based on historical data, requires the exchange of information between the customers and the commodity providers. So there's exchange of data, exchange of information, but I don't know that there's any information that's changed. This is not a mathematical process. There's no necessary computer involved in this method.
You like the state treat test, you say?
I would accept the state treat test.
Well, what do you consider it to be?
I would consider it to be a useful, as the words were used from Alipad, useful, concrete, and tangible result.
There are just three adjectives. What does concrete mean?
Well, it means it's reduced to a practical result, something that's useful.
Well, it seems like the three adjectives, and you're just saying, well, one of the adjectives just defines what one of the other adjectives means.
Well,
and useful is redundant because that's already in the language of 101, so that doesn't add anything. So we're now down to concrete, and what's the other adjective?
Tangible.
Tangible. So would you define for me what tangible means and what concrete means?
Tangible means being in the real world. Tangible means doing something that's physical and active in the case of a method.
Then what does concrete add?
I don't know.
I don't either. It doesn't sound like much of a test.
Well, it's consonant with the Supreme Court's test, as I read it, taken from those three cases that we keep focusing on.
Well, it may not be inconsistent, but it may not be complete either. It may be a part of a test, a half a test.
Well, I would say this. I would say that we all agree, I assume we all agree, that an idea itself is not patentable. So there has to be something that changes an idea that's being thought of as being abstract to an idea that would be acceptable to the Supreme Court.
And do we need a test in this area, or is this just an area that lists the areas of subject matter eligible, and the tests are found elsewhere in the statute, 102, 103, 112? Does there need to be a test for eligibility? The statute gives us the categories, process, articles of manufacture, compositions, etc.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, as far as categories, but there is this, we have to accept that over and over the court has seemed to accept it that abstract ideas, principles of nature and things like that are exceptions to...
So you're limiting the categorization to those three judge-made categories that are not eligible.
Indeed, and I only know, and the abstract idea is the only one that apparently has been applied in this case at the level of the patent office.
And concrete, tangible, and useful would be the antithesis of abstract, right? And that seems to be what Judge Rich was trying to do in State Street.
I would agree, Your Honor.
But if that's so, you just defined, in response to the Chief's questions, useful, physically doing something. So if you have an idea, and we all agree that's not patentable, an abstract idea, because it's useful, then it becomes patentable subject matter? Is that your position?
Well, I think it has to be in the real world, too. I think that I would agree that a process is totally mental, totally takes place in the human brain. It is not patentable, although I don't know why anybody would want to get a patent on such a thing.
So what gets something from the brain to the real world? What makes it real world? Because it involves physical activity?
In this specificity, in this case, it's that there's actually communication, there's third parties involved, there's activities of choosing two levels of fixed rate and a second fixed rate, and there's contracts, there's transfer of commodities, there's all kinds of real world activity taking place.
Mr. Hansen, isn't the test in Deere from the Supreme Court transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing? Isn't that quite different from useful, tangible, and concrete?
I don't believe the Supreme Court said that's the absolute test. I believe that the Supreme Court is saying that is a test for including subject matter in 101, but it's not a test for excluding it. And that language comes from the old Cochran v. Diener case, where claim was not held invalid. So I would say that test is only useful for including subject matter in Section 101 and not available for excluding subject matter for Section 101.
What about practical application? Earlier you said one of the litmus tests was a practical application. I guess the practical part of it's clear enough because we wouldn't want an impractical application. But how are we going to know when we're looking at a practical application versus something that doesn't qualify as a practical application of an idea?
Well, if practical, it works and it's useful. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, does it have to be a highly specific, limited kind of application in order to transform the broad idea or abstract principle or law of nature or algorithm, etc., into something that is eligible under Section 101?
The more specific a claim, the less general a claim, the more likely it is to claim an abstract idea itself.
So then when you say practical application, you really mean specific application?
No, I don't think so.
Or do you mean specific and practical application?
Right, I would agree.
How specific? Well, how do we know when it's specific enough?
Your Honor, about all I can say is that judges have to decide what's negligence, and that's the same kind of a thing.
Does that mean every time an examiner rejects an application under 101 and isn't reversed by the board, that we will have to decide each and every such case? Because otherwise no one will know whether the requirements of 101 have been met or not until we say so? Is that an efficient system?
Well, I don't believe that's an efficient system, but I think it's also very difficult to craft a bright line rule for things like this.
Well, how about a dim line rule?
Just said.
How about a dim line rule or any kind of rule?
Well, I'll tell you a kind of rule you could adopt. You could just say, look at the statute. It says process. If it's got a series of steps and they're useful, then it satisfies Section 101, and then go to 102, 103, 112, and decide whether you should issue a patent.
Well, I thought you said earlier that if it's purely mental, that it doesn't work. It has to be somehow in the real world, whatever that means.
Indeed. And I can't imagine why anybody would file patent applications on something that are not in the real world. I don't know what the damages would be for infringing such a patent.
In response to Judge Lurie, I think you answered that transformation is a sufficient category, but not necessary.
Yes,
right? Is that
correct?
Well, the language in Deere says transforming to a different state or thing is the clue to the patentability of a process.
Well,
so you read that as being a sufficient but not necessary, that language?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think you have to read every case in the context of the facts that are in front of it. And also, I believe that the court has been very careful to say that there was a little flag in there about, for example, or e.g., I think suggested the court didn't mean for it to be a hard, fast rule. I think that's been brought out in the briefs.
Mr. Hansen, is the question of the breadth or specificity of a claimed process a question of patent eligibility under 101, or is that more a question of 102, 103, or 112?
The breadth and specificity can apply to both. I mean, if a claim is so broad that it's not enabled, such as in the case of the Morse patent, then I think it's like what we would call today a 112 issue.
Certainly sounds like it.
Yes. But the broader a claim is, I would have to acknowledge, the more likely it is to cover an abstract idea. And what I'm trying to point out here, we have a lot of limitations in our claim that would distinguish the normal kind of things that people think of as being hedging. I mean, it doesn't cover insurance, it doesn't cover forwards contracts, futures contracts, options, calls and puts, all those kinds of things. And it's specific to how the various parties have to be configured. The market participants have to be in the same trade, involved with commodities. So there are a lot of specific aspects.
But those are really just field of use type limitations, aren't they? I mean, you're not really, there isn't any distinction other than simply saying this idea is being applied in a particular use, a particular field.
No, they are not just field of use, Your Honor. And I would point out that at the time the patent application was filed, IDS was filed, an information disclosure statement was filed, and two well-respected books on financial transactions called to the attention of the examiner. One is called Options, Futures, and Other Derivatives by J.C. Hull. Another is called Investments by William F. Sharp. And pages from both, and those two books describe, among other things, hedging. And nowhere in those books is there any description of managing consumption risk or hedging consumption risk. All the discussion is about managing price risk, exchange rates, insurance contracts, puts, calls, and things like that with regard to price. So this is unique, and this is a unique process in that it has to do with managing consumption risk, not just price risk.
You said earlier that this claim requires all sorts of real-world activity.
Right.
Is that a test, all sorts of real-world activities?
Well,
what does it mean?
Well, it just can't be practiced in the mind.
Well, we all agree on that. That's too easy. How much more than in the mind is required? That's where we need to survey the territory, because we need to have some principle or some test or some factors or some way of drawing a line. Because on the one side of the line, it's going to be held as eligible, and on the other side of the line, in a given case, it's going to be held as ineligible. So we need a little help.
Well, I would suggest that in this case, there's a substantial more activity than in some of the cases where there's just a calculation takes place and the number is written down, or the calculation is taking place and the number is used to.
So it's the quantity of real world activity limitations. If there are enough different limitations that seem to talk about real world activity, that pushes it over the line into eligible.
Well, and then I can just add the word, it can't be trivial. But I know that your comeback's going to be, what's trivial?
It's another adjective. It's like practical or specific.
That's what
or concrete.
Yeah, and that's what we've been working with, those kind of terms all our life. That's the kind
of thing. Where does it come from? You know, does the Supreme Court approve that test that you're advocating?
I think you draw that test from the Benson, Fluke, and
Deere. Draw it? Do they say that's the test?
Well, I don't think what they say that is the test is necessarily the test. I always thought that the stare decisis, you look at what the court says the material facts are, and then you look at the holding and you draw the rule from that.
So you're inferring the test from the cases. It's
I
not
think
there.
That's what you always have to do. And especially in this since this case involves no mathematical formula or mathematical algorithm, there's no direct application of those three cases to the Bilski claim. But you're right. I'm drawing it. I'm abstracting it from the holdings in those three cases.
Well, Mr. Hansen, this really is very helpful, because what I have been trying to figure out from the beginning of all of this, we know that most kinds of inventions for which people seek patents is for a certain economic purpose, and therefore there is a tangible and concrete and all the rest of it result. I'm trying to understand the area and how wide or narrow the area is in which we would have to do what you said. You said something like, to paraphrase, that's what judges are for. There is this narrow area, whether we're dealing with negligence or pornography that you know when you see or whatever, in which it is a case-by-case distinction. I'm trying to understand if it's possible to narrow that space and enlarge the space on all sides. We know we have the abstract ideas, we have the manifestations of nature, which we know are not patentable, and then we have the tangible and concrete, whatever that means, on the other side. What is this space in between? Where is it? It does seem to be arising more often than in the past. And what I'm trying to understand is whether there really is a large space of uncertainty, or whether in fact we're confronting policy and political, and I don't know a lot of other factors, which are themselves pushing the space of uncertainty. Have I explained the problem? I'm trying to understand just what, in fact, is the problem. Of course, a very good way to approach it in the common law system is by looking at your claims and saying, well, here it's tangible, concrete. It's not a transformation of matter, as the earlier cases did when that was the kind of invention that was made. It's more of an intellectual activity. But what is it? What is the area in which we're trying to see if we can draw a bright line?
You have 10 seconds to answer.
Well, thank you for the question. I think that in this day and age, when so much of innovation has to do with information, and information has become almost as important as matter and energy, that just because our invention mostly relates to the manipulation and use of information, such as entering into contracts or organizing organizations or whatever, we shouldn't say because information is involved, we have a special rule. To say how narrow it should be, this area that you're trying to get, this is a real challenge to craft such a rule. I'll acknowledge that. But I think if there's activity like there is in this case, where the person who would be practicing the invention has to go to one group of people, the consumers, and establish a price, a fixed price based on historical averages, and then go to another group of people and establish a second price to work a swap, I think that in that case there's been a lot of activity outside the mind, outside the brain, sufficient to make it acceptable under Section 101.
You say whatever the area, this invention is not in it. But you say that whatever the gray area, this invention is not in the gray area.
I would hope so, Your Honor.
Okay. You want to save the rest of your 8 minutes of rebuttal time? Very well. Thank you, sir. Professor Duffy, good afternoon to you. Welcome to the court. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The per se rules offered by the PTO and the Bank of America here today are fundamentally misguided for two reasons. The Supreme Court has been repeatedly offered the chance to establish per se rules in this area, and it has repeatedly declined.
Well, what should the rule be? What should it be if it's not a per se rule?
Rules, it should be a standard. It should be a standard that applies exactly the way the Supreme Court said. We should start with the statutory language, which is always the starting point.
What's the test? What's the right standard?
The right standard is that abstract ideas is one of the categories that is excluded from patentable subject matter. And there are a variety of factors that this court and the Supreme Court have considered. No per se rule has been drawn, and the court has refused to draw per se rules precisely because technology evolves and things change. In fact, when the Supreme Court has tried to draw per se rules, it has failed.
So you're not offering us a standard?
I'm offering you a standard, but not a rule.
What's the standard?
The standard is that an abstract idea is unpatentable. It has to be, if it's abstract, then it is unpatentable.
That's the only thing that's unpatentable?
Well, there are two other categories that the Supreme Court has noted. There are principles of nature and physical phenomena. And they've described them with various different words, which is why I think playing semantic games about what does this single word mean, it gets us off track. Each of these actually is connected up to the policies of the Patent Act. It's a judicial gloss on the language of Section 101. They're connected to the policies of the Patent Act. So, for example, abstract idea is connected to the policies that are enforced under Section 112 as well. And that makes sense from a jurisprudential standpoint, because if the court is going to place a judicial gloss on the clear words of Congress, which the court has repeatedly said literally cover quite a bit, and the court has repeatedly said should be interpreted, as noted, are extremely broad. That's the most recent 101 decision from the Supreme Court. Then the court should look to the policies of the Act in creating a judicial gloss, and it should proceed cautiously.
Professor Duffy, how would you draw the line between a non-patent eligible principle or idea and a patent eligible process?
The principle of nature process?
Any principle or idea? Where would you draw the line between just a principle or idea, which we all agree is non-patent eligible, and a patent eligible process?
I think that the court and Supreme Court has looked at a variety of factors. But one of the major factors that it looks at is how broad the claim is.
Well, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hansen. Is that a question of patent eligibility under 101, or is that a question of patent eligibility under 102, 103, or 112?
It's both, because the Supreme Court in its patent eligibility jurisprudence has repeatedly and constantly invoked concepts that are elsewhere reflected in the Patent Act. And that is the appropriate approach if the court is going to create a judicially created test on top of the language of this, that Congress used in defining patent eligibility. And so, for example, in Parker versus Flo, Justice Stevens, writing for the court, noted that post-solution activity that's obvious might be inappropriate to bring something into the patent eligibility realm.
Professor Duffy, what bothers me there is we have standards when we're talking about scope of a claim for enablement purposes. We're looking at a standard of one of skill in the art and what they can make and use, understanding the description. We have no such thing in 101. We have categories. So how do we apply these policies of 112 to a word like process or composition of matter? How do we honestly do that without recognizing we're just importing our own predilections?
Well, the court should be very cautious in creating this judicial gloss. I completely agree. I think that that's jurisprudentially sound. I think that's the current position of the Supreme Court, which in the last three cases on 101 that have gone to it have ruled in favor of patentable eligibility, twice rejecting the government's position that they have offered per se rules. So I think that in terms of a standard, I would look to the other area of 101 jurisprudence, utility doctrine. So, for example, in In re Fisher, the Supreme Court has said that there must be a specific utility. And this
But in Deere, the Supreme Court said that transformation is the clue to patentability. And it just seems that your position that you're taking is almost that we should turn a blind eye to that. And how does transformation then fit into your standard?
I think that it is a factor that the court should look to in terms of how connected something is with the real world. But the Supreme Court was specifically given the opportunity in Benson. Government's briefs.
Wait, your answer to my question is what? I'm sorry. It's how connected something is to the real world. That's your answer to how transformation fits into your standard.
I think that the transformation factor, it should be taken as a factor and not as a per se rule. That's my basic answer. So however you define transformation, I think that it is a factor. And as the court noted in footnote 12 of Schrader, transformation can include transformation of subject matter. That's actually the quote from Cochran versus Diener. And that includes transformation of intangibles as long as it represents something else that has a practical effect, practical existence in the real world. And I think money and flows of money do have practical existence in the real world and are not abstractions.
Do we have authority, or is it somehow only reserved to the Supreme Court to create a gloss? If the Supreme Court has articulated three, I'll call them no-nos, can't be eligible under 101, are we somehow foreclosed, presuming that we do it carefully, from creating a fourth no-no?
Well, I think if this court wants to follow what the Supreme Court has done, the court should look to Benson, where the government made the exact same argument that it's making here today on page 18.
No, I'm asking them a question about authority. Do we have the authority to create a fourth no-no, or do we have to wait for the Supreme Court to either do it or not do it?
Well, I think it would be adding an additional gloss onto the language, and I think the Supreme Court has said that it itself and lower courts, I think, should not add additional caveats onto 101. The Supreme Court has said that repeatedly. Well,
I thought they said you should do it only cautiously. So I'm trying to press you. Does caution go to the extent that we can't do anything, or do we have some leeway to either interpret the three no-nos or potentially add a fourth?
I think caution, there are many reasons for caution here, including that the Supreme Court was presented with the exact same argument and declined to adopt it. I'd also note that the government's position, and certainly Bank of America's position...
I'm not asking about adopting a requirement that it either be a machine or transform matter. I'm asking about whether other areas like abstract ideas or laws of phenomenon of nature could be articulated by this court, or whether you think we're precluded from such an exercise.
Oh, in terms of trying to give more definiteness to things like abstract idea, I think this court has authority. I think that is exactly what the court tried to do, and indeed I think successfully did in Ray Allopath.
How about creating a fourth no-no? We have authority to do that, assuming we do it cautiously and carefully and consistent with history and policy and precedent and so on?
Well, I need to know what that fourth no-no is. It's an abstraction until I know what it is. I've looked at the no-nos that the Bank of America and the Patent Office have offered up, and I'm quite confident that those ones, which have already been presented to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declined to adopt them, I think should not be adopted by this court if this court wants to follow the Supreme Court. And indeed, there's a specific reason for that. One good example as to why the PTO rule doesn't work is Claim 5 in the Morris case. Claim 5 in the Morris case was construed by the government standing here before this court a year ago as just an alphabet that was disconnected from signals. And that, I think, is something that if you run it through the Cochran versus Diener test, if you apply a per se rule, you get into all sorts of debates about, well, what's the connection, what's the physicality, and those debates, I think, are not profitable, and they're not wise in this area where you're creating a judicial gloss that's on top of the extremely broad language that Congress used.
Of course, if we transgress the intent of Congress, they can easily change it, just as they can if the Supreme Court gets it wrong by the lights of Congress. I mean, it's a statutory scheme, so the adjustment could be rapidly made if any level of court makes some mistake.
I certainly agree, but in the first instance, the courts, both the Supreme Court and the lower courts, should try to follow the intent of Congress rather than to depart from the intent of Congress. And the intent of Congress, the court... I see my light is on here.
The intent of Congress is to be amorphous?
Pardon me?
The intent of Congress is to be amorphous in this area?
The intent of Congress is to be broad. And there are other policies codified into the Patent Act that the court looks to in developing this very thin judicial gloss on the patent area. And I think that if the judicial gloss begins to call into question whole areas of emerging technology, like financial engineering, where there are numerous programs that are in engineering schools for financial engineering, and you think all of those are sort of outside the realm of patentable subject matter, that is not a small adjustment to the scheme that Congress has created here.
All right, let's hear from the government.
Thank you,
Professor Duffy. Mr. Chen, podium is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Chief Judge Michel, Judge Dyke, you've asked, what is the test for process? And how do we have a defined, meaningful standard? And the answer to that is basically the section of Diamond v. Deere that Judge Moore referred to. And I'm referring to section Roman numeral 2 of Diamond v. Deere.
Do you think a clue is a requirement? If transformation is a clue, we should treat the word clue as if it said a requirement? Must have transformation or never is eligible?
That's not correct, because that full quote says, transformation or reduction of an article to a different state or thing is the clue to patent eligibility for a process that is not tied to a particular apparatus. So there's really two boxes there in Diamond v. Deere where the Supreme Court said either or, a statutory process, as we define that term in Section 101, can be one of these two things.
Well, can you help us on what it means to be tied to an apparatus? Because we know from Fluke, for example, that it can't be any use of an apparatus if it's an insignificant use or post-solution activity, etc. that doesn't count as tied to an apparatus in order to impart eligibility. So how can you help us with that?
And I think to really answer that, it's going to have to go through the judicial process where it's going to be...
That's where we are.
That's right. But we can reaffirm the legal standard set out by Diamond v. Deere and then from there go forth and on a case-by-case basis sort of understand what does it mean to be insignificant surrounding activities or whether you really are meaningfully tied.
Well, in Comiskey, it seemed to be the suggestion as to whether the use of the computer or other machine or apparatus was a necessity, that to carry out the process as claimed, that let's say it was a computer, was a necessity. If it's not a necessity, then it's not tied in a meaningful way so as to impart eligibility. Would you accept that, or do you have a better suggestion?
As soon as we get down the rabbit hole of whether a computer is involved, it's too hard to be able to say computer automatically or telephone automatically makes you eligible. I think...
Doesn't a computer just do mental steps?
Excuse me?
Doesn't a computer just do mental steps? That's what a human would do if he or she could operate that quickly?
Well, that's not the position we're taking, and we're not taking that position today. All we're looking at today is whether Mr. Bilski's claim, which doesn't have a machine...
Well, you're not even taking a position that we should overrule State Street.
That is correct,
but,
because...
But isn't a computer as a machine simply mental steps by another means?
There's different ways of looking at how a computer works, and that is one way of looking at it, but there's other ways, too.
I used to do my tax return by hand, mental steps. I now do it through a computer. I don't have to tell you the name of the company, but that is essentially mental steps. It's doing the same mental steps, but faster. So isn't the use of a computer just mental steps by other means?
I don't think I could necessarily agree and take a position with you on that.
Judge Gallardo?
Mr. Chen, what is the meaning of transformation in State Street that comes out of Deere? Transformation and reduction of an article of a different state or thing is the clue to patentability.
Right.
Now, in State Street, Judge Rich wrote, today we hold that transformation of data becomes useful. What does that mean? Is that transformation required in order to make it patentable on the 101?
Well, the way we read State Street is that those transformations were being performed by a machine. That was a machine-implemented claim, and so at the very least, it can be said that there was a machine tied to that claim.
So does that mean that if the Bilski steps were performed by a machine, they'd become patentable?
Excuse me?
If the Bilski steps were performed by a machine, would they become patentable?
I can't give you an answer on that. It would depend on how that claim was written. And
maybe I'm confusing this with another brief, but I thought the government at least did offer, if not advocate, that the machine has to have a central role in generating a useful result. Is that not your view?
That would seem to be how all the Supreme Court cases that have...
So we don't need the word process in the statute. We just look and see if there's a machine, right?
No, I wouldn't.
Why did Congress put process in there?
Because it understood that processes can be a lot of different things. One
process can be divorced from machines, maybe?
If the process is transforming subject matter to a different state of things, for example, a human is combining...
Now, we're interpreting Section 101, right?
Yes.
And it lists the four categories, very broad terms. What does it say after that? What does 101 say after it gives us the four categories? May obtain a patent subject to what?
The other conditions?
Yes, exactly. In other words, maybe the test in 101 is to direct you to the other conditions, 102, 103, 112, right? Says so right in the statute.
I wouldn't go that far because as...
No, we're just reading the statute. Do you read it that way?
We are reading the statute as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court.
You think that the statute requires something beyond subject to the other provisions thereof?
I think the question of does a statutory process mean any series of steps performed by man? Is that what process means as it's used in Section 101? And the answer is no, because the Supreme Court has told us in the way it has interpreted the process that it doesn't run so far.
Do you think the Supreme Court has given us a rule for what a process is? It said at least twice that it is not giving us a general rule, that processes may be things other than what they've said. They were very careful to say that in both Benson and Fluke.
That's true, but then we have to look at what was the last word from the Supreme Court on what the meaning of process is, and that wasn't Benson or Fluke, that was Deere. And then you have to look at, okay, what did the court do at pages 181 to 184 of that opinion? It says, just like it had to do...
Is that the one that says anything under the sun made by the hand of man?
Yes, it took into account that. It also took into account...
Said, look at the statute and read those categories broadly?
It said you're supposed to give terms their ordinary meaning unless otherwise defined. It quoted Section 100B. It reminded itself that courts are not supposed to put limitations on the patent laws that Congress hasn't otherwise expressed. And so it considered...
So, for instance, you wouldn't limit the word process to require it to be done by a machine because you also have machine in the statute, right?
Well, yeah, I'm not finished with what the court did.
Well, but I'm wondering, I'm trying to reconcile what you're telling me with the language of the statute. Right. And you're telling me process is only a process if it's run by a machine. Why do we have the two words?
Well, first of all, it's not only run by a machine. There's also transformation. Secondly, the court in Deere was faced...
Then why doesn't this claim, which is so obvious that we're having trouble with it because it obviously isn't going to meet either 112 or probably 102, but why doesn't this claim transform?
Well, before I answer that, let me go back to what the Supreme Court did in Diamond v. Deere. They looked at all the factors of why they might go with a broad, ordinary meaning. But then they said that Congress essentially adopted the long-standing, developed understanding of what the term process meant in the courts when it inserted process in the 1952 patent.
Now you should answer the question.
Okay. This isn't a transformation because what are the kinds of transformations that the court has been talking about? They've been talking about articles and talking about physical things. Transformation of legal obligations of financial risks are, if anything, the transformation of something intangible. And so that is the distinction. And so we don't believe that the Supreme Court contemplated
so
the creation of contracts.
You're using Judge Rich's tangibility test to determine transformation?
We're using the Supreme Court's tangibility test to understand what is...
So we're going to have to decide if there are physical steps, and we're going to get back into what's physical and what's mental and everything that was rejected by State Street?
I don't think State Street rejected...
It rejected the belly test, which had us... deciding whether something was sufficiently transformational, if it had physical steps and so forth.
I think it's important to recognize that
Freeman Walter Abelli test
right.
was
and
rejected
what
by the State
Mr. Chen was the Patent Office applying in 1952 when the statute was amended.
What test?
Yes.
For
patentable subject matter.
Well, I imagine it was trying to define the types of inventions were always something that transformed something or were a machine implemented. If you're asking me what the specific test was the PTO was applying in 52, I don't have any particular knowledge of that. It was is, I'm sure, driven on whatever the laws were at that time. And the Supreme Court has told us what those laws were at that time when it defined what the meaning of process is.
Mr. Chen, as I recall your brief, you didn't suggest that State Street be overruled, did you?
That's right.
I thought you thought State Street was fine.
Well, we are seeking, for the purposes of this case...
Now, just stick with me for a minute.
Yes.
You support State Street as a proper case, consistent with Supreme Court law.
And
right?
No. My answer is, we don't have to reach that issue here in this case, because this case doesn't have to...
I don't know who you mean by we. We have to reach the issue in the case. You don't have to reach any issue.
That's true.
You just need to answer a few questions.
Pardon me. You, this court, do not have to revisit the facts and outcome of State Street.
Well, if we did, should we uphold it lock, stock, and barrel or not, according to your view that the transformation has to be of an article in view of the fact that what was transformed there was one number into another number, not an article?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts here. Let me remind the court that the test is machine implementation or transformation of an article to a different state or thing. And you can say that State Street was a machine, and we're not necessarily looking at the transformation of data as the same thing as transformation of an article. You can make an analogy between the two, but we're not saying that. But as to your answer of why we didn't ask for State Street to be overruled, it's because there's no reason to go all the way back to the facts of a computer-implemented invention for this particular case, which doesn't have a machine, it doesn't have a computer, it doesn't have software. So, in our view, it is inappropriate to go that far and reach all the way back and exhume State Street's facts and do a redissection of what that was. This court's order asked, is it appropriate to revisit State Street and AT&T? We say yes to the limited extent that some of the statements made in those opinions could affect the outcome of Mr. Bilski's case here. He wants a standard that says any series of steps made by man that has a useful result passes the 101. We disagree with that.
Mr. Chen, let me stop you there, because that's exactly what I'd like to pursue. I read the Supreme Court cases, starting with Benson, and then this Fluke and this Deer through Chakrabarty, as an evolving view of Section 101, which is directly, intimately tied to the facts of each case, each of which was new technology at the time, with the entry of computers and then the genetic manipulation and so on. So I have read those cases, and I think the office has read them, perhaps until now, as demonstrating keeping up with the times, keeping up with technological change, and adjusting the application of the law to recognize that there are lots of differences between now and 1793 in terms of what the patent system is supposed to cover. So now we come into, I use the word intangibles reluctantly, but nevertheless, with the progress of technology, there have been changes. And I just wonder, has the Patent Office studied the consequences? What would happen if, in fact, I know the board said that State Street should go, even if the office is not now pursuing it. Has the office studied what would happen if, in fact, we took some steps back in terms of this anything under the sun? What would happen to these areas of innovation? Would they benefit economically, technologically? Isn't that what we need to know? We're sitting here trying to legislate rather than decide specific cases.
The question is whether you've done a study.
Right. The answer is no, but in terms of your question, it's a real one. Whether innovations beyond the ones that fall within the Supreme Court's interpretation of process should be considered part of the patent system. And I think as soon as you have some parties say yes, you're going to have other parties that say no. And in that kind of situation, I agree that that's something for Congress to decide. That's a kind of a policymaking issue that Congress needs to decide. Now, Section 101 has been already interpreted, and that's what we're asking this court to reaffirm today. Chakrabarty, you're correct, is written with a tone that patent subject matter eligibility should be considered broadly. And then later on in JEM Ag Supply, they said Section 101 is it's a dynamic provision that should accommodate new inventions, new technologies. And we don't disagree with that. At the same time, Dante v. Deere came out 1 year after Chakrabarty, so the Supreme Court was already keenly familiar with the needs to try to keep Section 101 broad. And it had the opportunity to say, yes, we're just going to go with the dictionary definition, or these are just mere examples of what could be a 101 process, but we're not going to decide today whether there could be something else or not. We'll just let it come as it may, and we'll keep it open-ended. We don't believe that a plain reading of Dante v. Deere, that they did either of those things. They in fact, adopted the interpretation as based on their history and understanding of process patents. At the same time, we still feel like the Supreme Court recognizes that there should be a door left ajar for process patents where there is some hitherto unknown onrushing technology that doesn't quite fit within the existing standards that they set out for what should be a Section 101 process. So, in that
sense... So could software be one of those types? I'm wondering if your new test doesn't mark the demise of all software patents. And I'm not talking about the ones written in machine language, but actual software patents. And I'm wondering if software wouldn't be exactly the kind of, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago, hitherto unforeseen technologies.
Well,
that would warrant an exception to the transformation and tied to a machine
language.
If
software doesn't have a machine attached to it, then it seems like it's got some issues there that need to be corrected. Okay. Now, whether this test that we're talking about today that came from the Supreme Court, I don't see how it affects computer-implemented inventions one way or another. Because, for example, we know from that a software patent war has broken out among the amici here. But nevertheless, the question of a computer-implemented process, should that be eligible? At the very least, there's a computer there. But then there will also be a computer in the machine category of software patent claims. And then the more challenging question of, well, when is it or when is it not patent eligible? Both of those cases are going to be dealing with the same issues. Those are not issues that we have to resolve for today's proceeding, or this court does not have to reach those issues in this case. There's just no facts here, and that's why we believe it would, in fact, be inappropriate and dangerous to start opining on that issue when we don't even have a concrete set of facts here.
What about if this?
Against.
But on transformation, I mean, you've offered up transformation as one of the categories, a software method that only changes data in a computer. Forget the machine part. Is that a transformation that's adequate to fit your test of transformation?
Well, we don't, right now, our understanding is transformation requires a transformation of some physical, tangible thing.
An article.
What about a chiropractic method for adjusting someone's back? So you're adjusting the back, you're doing some physical, you're changing physical. I know the chiropractic example was discussed in detail in the first Bilski, and I thought you were saying it would not be patentable subject matter.
Well, I think what I said was it would be a difficult mind-drawing question to really understand what is going on there. But one could make an argument that maybe that is some kind of transformation of subject matter going on there when you realign someone's spine. But, I mean...
One could, but you're not?
Because I don't think I can legitimately say that the United States government has a position today on the eligibility of chiropractic relief.
What do you mean exactly, or as exactly as you can define it, by transformation? We've been kind of floating around with that term without really, at least giving, I haven't come away with a clear notion of just what it means to have a transformation of an article to a different state or thing. I mean, example, this may be sort of a play off the chiropractor, but you know, the famous example, well, is a curveball patentable? Well, you know, a curveball is a baseball which has been, you could say, transformed into a baseball that has a great deal of spin on it and is being thrown at a pace which it didn't have at the time it was in the pitcher's hand. Is that the transformation? Is that eligible for consideration as transformation, as you're using the term?
Right. I think that's problematic to say that is a transformation. The baseball itself has not really changed in character. Yes.
How about the process of throwing a curveball?
And again, I don't. The question is that really a transformation?
Right. Well, what I'm trying to get at is what is a transformation? Does it require that the baseball turn into a green pea or something? I mean, does it require something fundamental about a change in the very nature of the object, or can simply the condition of the object be temporarily or permanently changed?
Right.
Because we've been hearing a lot, and Mr. Duffy referred to transformation of intangibles, which seems to me outside of even the broadest concept, as you've expressed it, of what transformation has to be, transformation of physical objects.
Right.
But within the concept of transformation of physical objects, how would you see the lines being drawn?
I think a transformation of a baseball or a transformation of a golf ball, I feel like that's problematic. I don't see that as the kind of transformation that was really being contemplated by the Supreme Court. At a certain point, we're all guessing a little bit here, but at the same time, that's not what was going on in all those various cases. Like, for example, when you were...
Well, Mr. Chen, we also have composition of matter as a separate category from processes, right? In the listing in the statute.
Yes.
So certainly it can't require the baseball changing into a pea, right? That's a different composition of matter. So that can be covered by the composition of matter problem. Why isn't the process of throwing the curveball entirely a legitimate process? And then we'll look at 102, 103, 112 with all the insights of prior art and the knowledge of skill in the art and everything we can bring in with real standards to measure whether it gets a patent.
Let me put it this way. I think before we start building an examiner unit on how to throw baseball pitches, we'll probably bring that case to you first before we start.
Why isn't this case the case we're talking about?
Because this case is about contract formation. And that's a different...
Somebody's throwing a contract in a different way rather than throwing a baseball in a different way. It's the same case conceptually as posed to you by my colleague Judge Bryson. And I haven't heard an answer to his question.
I would have to disagree with that, because contract formation is in the world of intangibles. There is no actual physical thing that's been manipulated there. Here, with the baseball, okay, now we are rooted in some physical thing in the world, and now we're asking ourselves, okay, has that been transformed in the way that is contemplated for the patent system? And right now I'm very uncomfortable saying yes, that is appropriate and that is a transformation, because I think their transformation does require some kind of transformation of...
I think you're illustrating for me why the statute directs us to 102, 103, and 112 to make the decisions, and just list categories otherwise, because you can't tell me what transformation is any more than anyone else.
Your Honor, whenever there's going to be a legal standard issued, there's always going to be cases on the margins. That's just the nature of legal tests. And I don't think that Section 101 is some kind of preamble or warm-up act for the rest of the conditions for patentability. It is its own condition and statutory section that has to be evaluated and resolved. There are these four words in the statute, and we have to pay some fidelity to those four words. We can't simply jump to anything under the sun made by man. Okay, let's move on to 102, 103.
Isn't
these four words have meaning.
Isn't transformation conversion of physical subject matter in a chemical to another chemical or physical state?
Yes,
is that what you're arguing?
That is a transformation, yes. And so,
Is that just an example of transformation, or is that a definition of it?
Well, I don't know if you could say transformations are limited to the chemical variety.
Or physical,
because one could argue that you took a lot of components and then created some.
How about transforming some data into another data form?
And that's where we said in our brief that that's not the kind of transformation we understand it to be. But nevertheless, these computer cases.
Why? Because that's mental steps?
Well, I'm not saying that.
But isn't that what transformation was called in State Street? There was a transformation of data.
The full quote is data transformation by a machine. And I think that by a machine phrase.
Well, today that's not the language in State Street. That's what I'm trying to figure out. We hold that the transformation of data representing discrete dollar amounts by a machine to a series of mathematical calculations.
Right.
Does that mean that transformation by data by a machine is acceptable to the Patent Office? Then? You're not arguing against State Street.
I think, again, at least then you are machine implemented. There's going to be other factors you have to consider and evaluate in any of these computer-type cases.
But why should there be, if in fact it's new and unobvious and useful, and perhaps revolutionary, and doesn't meet these criteria of transformation or anything else we're talking about, I am concerned about saying, never mind, not in my patent office.
Well, the way we read Deere is there's really two separate inquiries you have to look at. One is, are you in the statutory category? And then secondly, is your claim nevertheless some kind of abstract idea, law of nature, or natural phenomenon? And those are two separate inquiries that have to be made. And just because
we survive those inquiries and get to the various stages that we're probing.
Right. Then, of course, the claim should be evaluated under 102, 103, and 112.
Is what you're saying that transformation is directed to covering manufacturing processes and processes for creating a composition of matter? Is that what that category is?
I think it is tied, in a sense, to the... You could argue that it is tied to the other three categories, but I don't think...
But you're saying tied to a machine or involving a transformation of matter. I'm asking you whether a transformation of matter is a shorthand for describing a manufacturing process or a process for manufacturing a composition.
Short answer.
I think the shorthand is probably yes, but I have to think about that a little bit more before I say conclusively that transformation is just those things.
Mr. Chen, it seems to me that position is might have great relevance in the industrial age, but sounds certainly regressive in this information age. How does that relate in any way, shape, or form to the reality of the inventions that the Patent Office is confronting now?
Well, these inventions in the information age, the electronic age, those inventions are all going to be somehow driven by machines. And so at the very least, the test can accommodate these types of inventions. And I know you had asked earlier about the preemption doctrine, essentially, why isn't that just something that's resolved under Section 112? And I think the short answer to that is the Supreme Court has indicated otherwise in Benson, when it said there that claim was written so broadly, so and sweepingly, that it preempted all possible applications of that particular mathematical formula. And it related back to all these 19th century cases, like Morse, and compared Morse to the telephone cases. And then there's many other cases, like Leroy v. Tatham, which Comiskey cited for the idea that you don't get a patent on an idea, or you don't get a patent for any implementation to achieve some result. You know, that's not appropriate, because that is some kind of overprotection that would prevent any kind of follow-on innovation in that area, which would violate one of the central tenets of patent law.
Thank you. Time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lee, good afternoon to you. Welcome to the court.
Afternoon, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
To please the court, my partner, Randy Moss, and I represent certain financial institutions or organizations that have appeared as amici in this case. We'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to allow us to address briefly the important issues raised by the February 15th order. We have proposed a factor-based test for determining whether an application satisfies the requirement of Section 101. And in particular, to distill the factors we've articulated in our brief, we ask or suggest that the appropriate thing to do is focus on three fundamental principles, two of which I don't think are in dispute, although the second probably requires some definition. First, abstract ideas and mental processes are not patentable, a proposition with which we all seem to agree. Second, processes that result in a physical transformation of matter are generally patent eligible. It would not include a curveball that was thrown, because the baseball would still be a baseball. It is broader than a manufacturing process that creates a new composition of matter. It is a broader test than that. It is more flexible than that. The third principle, which
then
we would suggest,
test?
Is
if
that
if it's more flexible than that, what's the test? How much further does it go?
Your Honor, I think you probably can look at how much further it goes by looking at the cases that have found there to be a transformation of matter. So you take Allopat, where there really has been a transformation because there is a different method and different actual display. If you take...
It was a machine. It was claimed as a machine.
It is a machine, Your Honor, but it's also part of the decision, part of the discussion, examines it as a machine, examines it also as a method. And one of the hard parts in unpacking the decisions, if you look at them, is in State Street, the suggestion was whether it's claimed as a machine or claimed as a method was not important to the analysis. We would suggest it is important to the analysis, and that if there is a physical transformation of something, then it's a patent-eligible process. It need not be tied to a machine, to go to a question that Judge Rader asked earlier. You can't have a process not tied to a machine, not tied to an apparatus.
But wasn't State Street claim tied to a machine? It was a machine claim, wasn't it?
And it was not a transformative process. And Judge Garris, we go into your question, and this is the place where we in the PTO depart, and we may be at the far end of the bell curve, but the transformation of data alone does not, in our view, fall within the transformation that's described in Cochran versus Diener. And we suggest that that is the clue, as Diener says. We suggest that it's particularly important because when in 1952 the word process made its way into the statute, Cochran had been in existence for 75 years. It was governing authority for 75 years at the very moment in time that this came in. Now, we're not suggesting that we should limit ourselves to this. We have also suggested that there can be non-transformative processes that could be patent eligible.
Why hasn't the process of throwing the ball transformed its flight path?
It has transformed its flight path, Your Honor, but the thing, I would suggest, is
the thing is throwing a ball. The thing is not the ball itself. The thing is the process. The process is not the composition of matter. The ball is the composition of matter. That's separate from process. I have a process, throwing a ball along a flight. Now I want to transform it into throwing it along a different flight path according to a absolutely novel process.
And Your Honor, we actually thought about this in preparation, thought about it in terms of throwing a baseball or your golf swing, which is the same thing, I think. And under our test, without a doubt, they would not be patentable. They would not be processes that Congress had in mind when the word made its way in 1952. They would not fall into either of the two categories of processes we propose.
Why didn't the Congress then say processes except those that affect flight paths of baseballs or some other exception that would make your play on the words here make sense? You want us to rewrite the words, but they didn't rewrite the words, did they?
No, and I don't think we're asking you to rewrite the words. I think what we're suggesting is that the word process made its way into a statute against a historical backdrop. The historical backdrop was that when the word art made its way into the patent laws early in the history of this republic, there was concern about methods of doing business and mental processes, in large part because the king in England had given patents on processes that had existed for years to people as favors and grants. Against that backdrop, you have Cochrane decided in the 19th century. Cochrane focuses on the transformation. Now, to be sure, the biotechnology field that Judge Newman has raised, the software field that Judge Moore has raised, they were not in existence at the time Cochrane was decided. And we're not suggesting a test that will freeze us today and make us unable to deal with new technologies. We're suggesting that the factor test we're offering is one that would be flexible enough to deal with the new rasterized vernalopet, to deal with the new method of curing rubber, but at the same time, take something like State Street, which fundamentally is something that the invention, or what was invented, stopped before you ever got to the machine or the computer. And that's why we have articulated the third factor, which is the place that we depart from the PTO and where we depart from Comiskey, by saying that you can have a non-transformative process if it is in some manner tied to a machine in a non-conventional way.
Let me stop you right there, because conventional sounds like 103. This sounds like obviousness. If it's conventional, it's not patentable under 103 because it's already in the prior art. Yeah. So how can we have a test for 101 that uses the 103 test?
Your Honor, there are two answers to the question. One is that the candid answer is that each of the analyses under 101 is going to have some overlap with 102 and 103. And Fluke and Benson and Deere all recognize that overlap. If there was no gatekeeping function in Section 101, and it was just left so that if you had a State Street idea tied to a machine, and the question of its patentability was then left to 103, you're going to have to sort through